Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by AOL Radio at AOL.com/podcasting. This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, episode 65 for August 6th, 2006, The $60 Million Man. All right, let's get started then. We've got a great panel, and I'd like to introduce everybody via cell phone because he can't get grounded from Los Angeles. He's back in the States, ladies and gentlemen, Cory Doctorow.
Howdy.
It's great to have you back on TWiT. And we'll talk a little bit about what you're up to because you're no longer the European Affairs Coordinator for EFF. You're in L.A. now. What could that mean? We also have Will Harris from Britain, who very kindly stepped out of the way for Jerry Pournelle last week, so we owe him one. Hey, Will.
Hello, how's it going?
bit-tech.net, and you were up late last time. I think it was, what, 2 in the morning when we bumped you.
So yeah, something like that.
I apologize. also with us, the poster boy for Web 2.0, ladies and gentlemen.
No.
We're just proud of you, Kevin, although the picture on the front of Business Week wasn't exactly the best picture of you.
Oh, I have a story about that. We can talk about that.
All right. And then, of course, to anchor this whole mess, John C. Dvorak, who only got one plug in last week.
I only need one plug, dvorak.org/blog. I'm in business.
Is it that good? Does it work that well, really?
Well, you know, it's actually diminishing returns. At some point I noticed that, you know, I got a bunch of, I got a run up and then it's pretty much nothing now. I mean.
Nothing. You get nothing, huh?
I get nothing.
So you just appear for the out of the goodness of your own heart. Well, I thank you very much. You did blog this week about Kevin's cover. And we might as well just start off with that. I'm first of all, Kevin. Embarrassed or not, I think it's wonderful. I mean, you're getting a lot of recognition from Business Week. It was kind of the accounting in the article is a little strange. As they pointed out in the article, your dig is breaking even, but on the front page, they say this kid made $60 million in 18 months.
Actually, a dig isn't even breaking even, so they got that wrong.
Hey, Kevin, you're taking us out to dinner tonight with all that money?
$60 million?
I'm not a multimillionaire. I'm not even a millionaire or a thousandaire. I don't know how they came up with that cover, but I guess it was just based on they put a value to the company. And then
$200 million. And you have 40%.
They estimated how much. Yeah. It's all estimates, and obviously it's just paper fake money. So
hey, I thought, well, Leo, you kind of liked that piece. I thought the article read like a slipshod hit piece.
Really? You think it was a hit piece?
It would seem like it to me. It was snide. He called him a kid. I mean, the guy, you know, Kevin's 30 or close to it. And, I mean, if you look on the picture, he's got a 6 o'clock shadow, for God's sake. I mean, he doesn't even look like he's young in that thing, except for the crazy outfit.
And they called him
had all these
Tom Cruise's doughier little brother. And, yeah, they were some
snotty
stuff.
And about the tech TV loser, you know, kind of a loser on tech TV, you know, unknown. I mean, the whole thing just rang.
You're right. I'm mad as hell now. I'm mad. Dang it.
No, it was pretty crazy how they came up with that cover shot. So the whole deal was going into this, honestly, it was just an interview for, we were going to be one of the companies featured in the article. We had no idea it was going to be a cover or anything like that until the actual day that it went out to press. So,
oh, they didn't even warn you before that?
No, they said there's a possibility it might be, but they go, we want to take a photo of you, you know, come out and... you know, it's for the inside of the magazine. Just, you know, there's guys walking their dogs. There's guys with hockey gear on. You know, do something fun. So, like, they're all throwing some headphones and, you know, just give us a couple different poses. So,
did they give you the backwards cap or was that your idea?
No, they basically, I mean, they had me, like, drinking a beer.
Oh,
they had me doing all different kinds of things. And they're just like, you know, we'll see whichever one makes it.
Kevin,
did they get you to try one of those crazy tennis shoe lacings that all the kids are into these days?
No, I didn't have to do that.
You got to get a handler.
I had to draw the line somewhere.
You need a man. You need somebody to protect you from this stuff.
It is
a mixed blessing, though, to be on the cover of Business Week.
Of course.
It?
I mean, I'm honored to be on the cover, but I mean, I was with the whole $60 million. This kid made $60 million. I didn't make anything. You know, the company while we have a path to becoming a profitable company, we are not a profitable company. You know, we're continuing to to work on that with Federated Media and some other companies that we're signed up with to serve ads on the page. And
go Federated Media.
What's that?
This is John Battelle's company. They sell banner ads, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Go Federated Media.
And why do you say that, Corey?
Well, because that's where Boing Boing gets its money, too.
Oh, all right. Good. Yeah. Is Boing Boing all Federated Media? You don't have anybody else on there?
Yeah. Well, no. So it's a little complex because John's also personally our business manager. So I think he occasionally does deals on our behalf with entities other than Federated Media, but it's pretty much all Federated Media.
Battelle was a journalist.
Yeah. Well, and an entrepreneur. He founded the Industry Standard.
It's kind of an interesting thing, now he's selling...
Kevin, did you prefer the alternate cover that got posted?
What was the alternate cover?
Ah, yes. You mean the 40-year-old virgin one?
Yeah.
The comparison? Striped shirt. That was awesome.
Wait a minute. Where's that? I didn't see that. Was that on Dig?
Yeah, there's like a bunch of different alternatives out there, which are just amazing. They're really cool. A bunch of people with Photoshop.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I think... In some ways, this kind of attention is a bad thing for a company because it puts pressure on you. It of course, a lot of weasels come out of the woodwork saying, "Hey, kid, I can hunt for you with that $60 million."
It was really actually the day it was posted. I had someone from Goldman Sachs email me like, "Hey, if you need money management," I'm like, "I can't even afford a couch. I just moved into my new apartment. Leave me alone. Like this is I don't have $60 million."
Oh, I'm sure it's going to be an avalanche at some point of stuff.
Yeah, it was pretty funny.
Bugging you. So tell me about John Battelle's strategies with Federated Media, Corey. Is it more than just banner ads? What's the idea behind that?
Well, I think the idea is that there are sites out there, or rather there are advertisers out there that want to advertise to fairly large, high-quality audiences. So sort of an order of magnitude larger than the average blog might have. And the transaction cost of going out and doing, say, 100 deals with 100 blogs is pretty high. And so I think John's basic premise is he goes out, he finds a bunch of really kick-ass blogs, kick-ass websites that have inventory to sell and that have a unique and distinctive voice, figures out which advertisers might be a good fit for them, and then goes to the advertiser and says, I can sell you advertising I can sell you 30 million impressions on the following sites, and then he can go to the creators and he can talk to them about whether or not those advertisers are appropriate for
them. So he sells it. He's an aggregator then of the eyeballs.
Yeah. On both sides. Yeah. He's aggregating blogs, he's aggregating advertisers, and unlike something like say Google Ads, where you've got to you got to feed them some editorial control, and the relevance isn't so high, and you don't really have any exacting fine-grained control over who gets to advertise with you. And Battelle gives you a lot of control over who gets to advertise with you, and he doesn't try to have any editorial control over what you post. Basically, once you and he have a deal, you write your site, and he helps you find the right advertisers based on what you're posting. He doesn't try to tell you to post something different.
Sometimes you get comical results from Google Ads. They really don't seem to do a very good job. In fact, I'm looking at your blog now, John, and the very first Google ad on your blog says, "Meat species testing."
So, the Google ad thing is only there.
Scrapple genotyping. I don't even understand.
It's Google Ads. Oh, not, I'm telling you. I don't think they do a very good job.
Yeah, I think they do it. The more I experience them, the worse it seems to be. It doesn't seem to be a very good job.
But isn't the issue with Federated Media that there's a point at which it becomes uneconomic? Because for a really big site, for example, like Dig, surely giving away, say, 50% of the revenue to Federated Media is a lot less efficient than just hiring somebody.
Why don't you sell it yourself?
Sales.
Yeah.
Well, honestly, for us, it's just, you know, we're a small team we're all developers and ops people. So
absolutely,
we're focused
but at
right
some
now.
Point doesn't, down the line, doesn't it become more efficient?
BitTech does its own ad sales, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
You have a salesperson.
Well, we have a couple of guys because there comes a point where, you know, if you're in a specialist field, you know who all the advertisers are, and who better to sell your advertising than the guy that sits in the office with you every day and understands what you're doing.
Right.
And of course, they're only selling for us, as opposed to trying to sell for. You know, it's to me, it looks sometimes like a bit of a conflict of interest, because if you're selling for say 40 different sites, and you know a company has budget to go on say one or two sites, well, how do you decide you know, where they go necessarily.
Yeah, it's one of those things where we've actually had a couple advertisers approach us directly and say, hey, we want to advertise on Digg, and FM doesn't lock you into any type of exclusive relationship with them. So we can use their ad engine to basically push any campaign that we direct sell, and then they don't take a cut out of that. So, yeah, at some point, you know, as more and more people learn about Digg and want to advertise directly on Digg, they can contact us and we can do that. But right now, they just have a huge sales force that go out and, you know, bring in the IBMs and Lenovos and Hitachis of the world, and it's so easy for us.
The reason this is a relevant discussion is really Web 2.0 seems to be fueled by, or it needs to be fueled by, on-site advertising. So if it doesn't, you know, it's got to work if Web 2.0 is going to work.
Right? I don't know. How relevant is this, Leo? I think people out there are going to fall asleep.
Well, that's why I was trying to make it relevant. All right, fine. All right, enough of that. You didn't go to DEF CON, Kevin. Is this the first time you didn't go this year?
I know. I missed it. Well, you know, it's growing up in Vegas, I went quite a bit, but it is one of those things where I just didn't have time to break away this year.
I think that's probably why Patrick is not with us. I forgot that he probably is at DEF CON.
Yeah, he told me he was going.
Yeah, so, and he's smart enough not to try to use the internet while at DEF CON. Did you see the Mac OS X hack, 30-second hack? Is that scary?
That's scary. That's really scary.
Would somebody clarify for me, because I can't tell from the coverage, and I have been too lazy to watch the video, did they use a third-party Wi-Fi card or the built-in Wi-Fi card? Nobody knows.
From what I understand, it was the built-in, right?
It was the built-in one. See, that's scary.
Because it was an issue with
Leo, explain to people out there what happened, because I don't think everybody's
It was a demo, I think, originally done at Black Hat, and then I think they might have done it again at DEF CON. But a couple of hackers. Now, this is where it gets a little dicey. They didn't do the demo live because they didn't want people to know how to do it. They also were at pains to point out it's not a specific Mac issue. It's a problem with many Wi-Fi drivers, including many Wi-Fi drivers on Windows. But they were able to own a MacBook getting in through the Wi-Fi drivers, because basically Wi-Fi is promiscuous, in 30 seconds in this video. And you know, Intel shortly after this came out updated their drivers. I don't know if they fixed that flaw in their own drivers, but apparently it's still an issue. And I did get a Mac update a couple of days ago. I don't know if they fixed that or not.
I don't believe so. A friend of mine from Apple said that they're working on it right now. So I don't know.
Does it mean that if you walk out into the wild world with your Wi-Fi on, you're vulnerable?
Well, I don't think the exploit has been released to the public, so only a small group of people would have this.
Well, or rather, we don't know how many people have it, because the whole point of not releasing an exploit like this to the public is it presumes that they're the first people who ever discovered it.
Right.
You know, I'm a full disclosure guy. I think it's pretty silly to say, you know, trust us, we're the only ones who figured it out. No one else will figure it out, especially now that we've told everyone that it can be done and given them hints of which direction to try. I'd actually be pretty concerned.
What do we do?
Which sucks for me, because I have a MacBook.
Yeah, me too.
The good thing about Wi-Fi hacks, I think, from a security perspective, is that you're only vulnerable to people within a couple hundred feet of you most of the time.
True.
As opposed to, you know, OS-level vulnerabilities where you're potentially vulnerable to much larger pools of potential attackers. So if there are only 10 people in the world who care enough about you or are malicious enough and indiscriminate enough to attack you, the chances of them being within 300 yards of you are a lot less than the chances of them being connected to the internet somewhere in the world.
Any other interesting hacks at DEF CON?
Well, I think they pointed out that the ARFID chips that are being used, I think maybe from next year in U.S. passports, were easily cloned.
Yeah, they cloned the passport. Well, actually, they cloned European passports, yes?
Yeah, also because
they're using the RFID as well. Yeah.
They read them with, they were partially open as well, as I understand it, which is of course, one of the big concerns is that you speaking of discriminate, indiscriminate, if there's an attacker out there who doesn't care which American they attack, provided that they're attacking Americans,
right,
then if these passports are even partially open, it appears that they can be read potentially at a great distance.
If they're closed, they're somehow shielded?
Yeah, I think that the passport material its cover has some sort of shielding property. I don't know if they've embedded some kind of Faraday mesh in it or something.
Seems pretty weird. It's like the old tin foil argument, isn't it? We'll cover your passport in tin foil and you won't get, you know.
People will be huddled over their passports when they open them.
Well, you know, for at least a year now, there have been a couple of border crossings, one in Canada and one in Mexico, land crossings into the U.S., where foreigners who come in have been issued RFID-readable cards that they're intended to carry at all times.
Really?
That are potentially readable at great distances.
Like a Visa.
Yeah, well, more like a prisoner ankle bracelet, I think.
Jeez Louise. You know, they give it to every
foreigner in the United States, yeah.
They go through everyone who goes through has to wear one?
These two crossings, it's a pilot program. It's a pilot program.
Oh, my goodness.
One is in, as I recall, upstate New York into Ontario, and then the other one was somewhere in Mexico. I forget what state it came out of.
And as a Canadian, you have to do that, huh?
Well, if I crossed at that crossing, right. Lucky.
Oh, just take and throw it out.
Well, yeah, that sounds like a good theory, John, until, like, you run afoul of the Department of Homeland Security who discover that you've committed some technical violation and use it as the basis.
And now you're in Gitmo, baby.
Yeah. How many times have you been stopped, Corey?
Lots.
Really?
I've been in and out of the United States on different visas for 7 years now.
But he carries that metallic Bill of Rights in his wallet. I know.
And I carry the metallic Bill. No, I've had a lot of problems at the American border at various times.
Really?
For various reasons.
Well,
yeah.
What is a lot of problems to you? Because I have problems myself when I come in from Canada. They just like to harass you.
You're a U.S. citizen. There's a difference. I mean,
I know they still give you a bad time, especially if you just come in from Canada. Last time I came back, they're grilling me why I went to Canada in the first place. As if it was like some horrible place I shouldn't be going.
Yeah, and it's really tough when you're trying to explain what you do for a living, when what you do for a living is something that's not readily explicable. And then there are all these trick questions like, well, you write novels. Will you be working on these novels while you're in America? Do you have a visa to write novels while you're in America?
Oh, my. Is that a trick question? If you say yes.
And I don't even know what the answer to that is.
You need a work permit to write a novel?
Well, will you be blogging while you're in America? Is the blogging for an American firm with, servers in Toronto? I'm not really sure,
Yeah.
So, one of the things they have, my people, as it were, the border guys in Port Angeles, Washington, where I cross a lot, they tell us sometimes some of the things you have to look out for in the next upcoming cycle. And the last one we were told is that when you come, because we always bring a lot of Rogers chocolates in.
Oh,
from,
I can't
Victoria.
Wait. Yeah, from Victoria. Oh, I'm excited. I'm going there in a couple of weeks.
There's a trick question coming up, which is that if you bring in food, will this be a gift? And you have to answer no.
I'm eating it myself.
It's all for personal consumption because apparently if it's a gift, there's some new rule about that, and they're going to just confiscate the chocolate and eat it themselves.
I go into Canada monthly, and actually it's a very smooth process. I have a work permit, so the Canadian crossing's pretty straightforward. I do notice the customs guards sometimes are in a bad mood. But everybody gets in a bad mood, but I haven't yet been harassed.
Are you paying taxes up there, Leo?
Yeah, absolutely. I get paid in Canadian dollars, too.
I found U.S. and Canadian customs guards often to be very surly, compared particularly to British ones. I lived in the U.K. for 3 years, and they were pretty good about it. My passport went through the laundry, and the British Home Office charges £500 to glue your visa into a new passport, and so I'm just still using it.
Wow.
And I've got a lot of other visas glued in there, too, that I just don't want to.
So is it soft and fuzzy now, a little furry?
It's a little, yeah. It looks like a little water damaged. And generally speaking, they've been cool about it. Most border crossings are cool. But the British ones always say, went through the laundry, didn't it? And I say, why, yes, it did. And they say, welcome back to Britain, sir. And they give it a little stamp.
I like that.
The crazy ones were the Russians who went berserk over this.
Yeah.
I've got a theory that the more border hassle there is, the less likely it is that you ever want to sneak into that country in the first place. Right. The two biggest ones I've had in the last year were Uganda and Russia. And I don't know who's going there to steal jobs from, lucrative jobs from Russians, man. My family just wants to get out.
I'm smuggling rubles.
Yeah, really.
They gave me, when I went in, of course, it was in a cruise ship, but they gave me a red thing. It's like a red, like, bookmark in my passport. It's like a day pass. But it didn't say anything. It was just a piece of plastic. And then as you're going out, they collect it back. I mean, it was the most primitive means I could think of to kind of, I guess, count people coming and going. I don't know what it was all about. It seems
that's
to me,
there's
a country where they do it just out of habit. There's no rationale.
I met someone who worked for the State Department when the Soviet Union was falling apart, who worked on advising former Soviet republics on border formalities. And one thing that she discovered is that because everyone who was in a position of power in those countries had the experience of going to the U.S. and getting the full visit to Dr. Jellyfinger, full at RecoPro background check, everything, that they decided that was the mark of a civilized country.
Oh, dear.
And they wanted to show that they were as grown up as America was, and so as a consequence, everyone who came in and out of their country was going to have to spend a day lining up at their embassy in some country somewhere else to get a full-page visa glued into their passport.
Isn't that adult? You come into the States frequently, Will. Do they give you the eye scan and the thumbprint and all that stuff?
Oh, yeah. You've got the full bonanza. But they're generally, they're pretty professional about it. Apart from, I saw one guy, one customs official pulled a gun on somebody for chatting on their cell phone in the queue.
You know, that's funny. He pulled his gun. I saw the same thing happen. He didn't pull his gun, but he was infuriated as if that somehow he'd violated some you know, terrorist ban. He was talking on the cell phone. It wasn't even as he approached.
You're not
it was
supposed
in the
to,
line.
But everybody, you know, texts their girlfriends or whatever.
Actually, rang. He didn't even pick it up. It just rang, and the guy
there
flew
are signs
off the
all
hand.
Over the place, Leo, in San Francisco, that you're not supposed to have your cell phone on
because it's impolite.
No, because they don't want people saying, okay, there's only so-and-so's not working aisle three. Go there because you can smuggle the goods in.
Yeah, you know, we can play movie plot threats all we want, but, like, if the test for whether or not we're going to implement some security measure is whether we can imagine some new quantum of security arising from it and not whether it's worth the trade-off that you pay. Like, you know, one of the things I've noticed is that when you land in America, they give you a very long form to fill out that has a lot of questions that you might need to phone someone to get the answer to, like, hey, what's your zip code person I'm staying with?
Right.
And so, you know, it can't just be, well, we can imagine some sequence in which doing this might make us secure from some attack, and that's it. We've decided that's, you know, that's something that we need to secure ourselves. I mean, that way lies, you know, if we're going to keep doing that, we might as well tranquilizer dart everyone on the airplane, you know. I mean, we'd be more secure, technically.
Yeah, blindfold and hood them before they come in the country. If I whipped out my BlackBerry and started typing, would they pull a gun on me? I wonder.
I think they should shoot you just for having a BlackBerry.
Just for doing that.
Hey, so what we're talking about San Francisco.
Worldwide Developers Conference, baby.
Yeah. Kevin, do you have the scoop?
Oh, I don't this year. It sucks.
You were the guy who predicted the Nano. That's right.
I have my insider, but they're gone now.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know why they're gone.
Yes, I do.
Well, the rumors are an Apple phone. I don't see that happening. Anybody believe there'll be an Apple cell phone?
No. God, no.
Heaven, no. That's the last business they'd want to get into.
I think just being beholden to the music industry is enough. They also want to be beholden to the carriers, those paragons of forward thinking.
AT&T, take me away.
Yeah.
How about I think it's pretty clear they'll do a Conroe desktop, yes?
Well, they have to.
Yep.
Everybody else has done one.
They're going to have the chips, not in great supply, but they'll have them. Will they do here's a question, will they do a four-way? What do you think, Will? You were the one singing the praises of a four-way camera.
Only if they decide to introduce the Mac Pro. I mean,
I'd love to see a four-chip.
Oh, four-chip. I thought you meant four-way.
Would
I was
be
sure
two
they
chips.
Were going to do that.
They'll definitely do four-way, but eight, it would be effectively
eight-way. Yeah, but it's not going to involve a computer.
What will it involve?
Oh, bro.
Oh,
never
I'm
mind.
Sorry. I'm slow. I haven't been reading the Dvorak blog lately. I'm sorry. I have to catch up.
So, hey, you know, just to change the subject.
No, not yet.
Bit.
We haven't defeated all the rumors.
Oh, please.
Come on. There's got to be something good.
Did you see the section of the show.
No. Did you see the picture taken through the window of the conference?
Yes. All the new icons? Is that what you're talking about?
And then there's another one that says introducing...
stop the presses. Stop the presses. New icons.
No,
it's exciting.
Wait a minute. What is this one, though? It says Mac OS X Leopard introducing...
Vista 2.0.
Vista 2.0. Is that their selling point? Oh, I guess it is. I get it. Yeah, all right. It's a little bit better than Vista.
Oh boy, that's something to brag about.
Better take praise,
All right. There's nothing to say, in other words. Nothing to see here. Move on.
Hey, I got the story that's been overlooked by everybody.
Good.
This is the 15th, last Tuesday, and nobody covered it.
The World Wide Web.
Yeah, what happened? How come it didn't get it? It got very little play.
It turns 15 on August 6th. That's the day that the links to the computer code for the World Wide Web were put on alt.hypertext so that others could download it and play with it. So in a way, this is the day the World Wide Web was born.
Right, today. I'm sorry.
Today, yeah.
It was on a Tuesday on August 6th in 1991. The original memos floating around the net.
It's kind of... Yeah, that's the nice thing about, you know, the news groups. You could see Linus Torvalds' first Linux posting. You could see the first posting of the World Wide Web. I think that's kind of cool. So, what? What, do you want to have a cake? What should we do?
And Kevin's buy-in.
Let's dance, yeah. A $60 million cake.
Albertsons. Luckies. I'll make it happen.
I mean, I think it's worth certainly nodding a hat. 15 years. It's not very long, is it?
It seems bizarre to have existed in an age without the internet now, doesn't it? Because it's just so pervasive.
Well, you're 23, right? You're the youngest on the panel.
Right.
So you were 8 years old when this happened. I, on the other hand, was 35. 30, so, I mean...
I just remember, getting to 13 and suddenly desperately, clamoring my parents to try and get me, a 28K modem.
Yeah, right.
I was like, please get me on the internet, please.
Kevin, you were 15. Do you remember the first time you saw... It was probably Lynx or something. I remember seeing the web on Lynx. It was the first time I saw it, I think.
Yes, mine was all through kind of bulletin boards. I started off with email that was tossers through BBSs, so I really didn't have access to the true, World Wide Web at that point.
I remember being on the Well, which was essentially a BBS, but you could drop into a shell account on the Well, and then you could run Lynx. And this must have been 1990, 1991, must have been fairly early. And I remember kind of the overwhelming feeling that there's a lot of, that the world is a big place. There's a lot of people out there on the internet. It was kind of an interesting experience. And of course, there weren't very many relatively at the time.
I had just dropped out of university to be a CD-ROM programmer for Bob Stein in New York, just around, 3 months before that all melted down. And so I found myself without anything to do. And so I decided that I would see if any ad agencies wanted to pay me to develop a Gopher site for them. And I actually talked an ad agency into it. And halfway through the project, I walked in and said, you've got to see Mosaic. It kicks ass. There's going to be hundreds of websites someday. Why don't we do that instead? And we did.
Wow. That's cool.
And there were hundreds.
And you were right.
Like 2 minutes.
Yeah. It is pretty. I do remember the first time I saw Mosaic, because that, going from Lynx to Mosaic was probably an equal jump, where you have a graphical browser all of a sudden. Then it made sense. Then it really made sense. And I remember the first time I saw an animated GIF. But that's a story for another day, kids.
What was the first time you had a pointless argument about whether it was GIF or GIF?
Yeah, it's GIF, I think, isn't it? It's GIF. I think I should say GIF. Somebody sent me the link to the page where the guy who invented it is a little bit testy about the whole thing and says
it's like the famous clip. My name is Linus Torvalds and I pronounce Linux.
I think probably people who install SUSE these days don't hear that anymore, and that's a shame. That used to be the sound test. When you got your sound card working, you'd hear Linus say that. I love that. Actually, people are getting Linux pre-installed for the first time ever. Lenovo's putting SUSE on ThinkPads. I think that's pretty exciting.
Even as we speak, I'm installing Ubuntu on a ThinkPad that finally arrived from Lenovo after more than 2 months.
But it had Windows on it, though, when you got it, no doubt.
Yeah, I don't know. I pulled the hard drive out. I bought the cheapest, smallest hard drive they have and then bought a third-party drive.
You didn't even look.
I didn't even look, no. It's on a shelf here. I'm probably going to use it to put MP3s on or something.
Isn't that funny? So are you've gone to Linux now. You've kind of abandoned Mac for Linux?
Well, no, like I said, I'm presently, while we're on the phone, just clicking a bunch of OKs as I'm installing, like it was yesterday that the last part of this machine arrived from Lenovo. I went through Lenovo hell getting this machine. So far, advantage Apple in terms of in terms of the experience of actually getting the hardware shipped to you. Lenovo is pathetic.
But I do remember reading about you and others.
Yeah.
Saying maybe it's time to abandon this closed source, proprietary thing called OS X and move to Linux. How are you feeling about that?
Well, so for me, there were a bunch of things that drove that. I mean, the mailer switching to individual files that were no longer mbox files that I couldn't extract. I mean, the number of successful migrations I've had of my mail over the years is very large, but it when it goes into those proprietary chunks, then you lose stuff. I mean, I lost 100,000 mails moving away from Entourage at one point and swore never again mbox files for me forever.
Yep.
And, now I've got a couple million pieces of archived email, and I'm just scared that I'm never going to get it out. And, I've got Aperture in my arm like a junkie, and I want to get out of there. I want to get my photo metadata out before my photo collection gets so big that I'll be stuck there forever. But the big one for me, and it's kind of a theoretical risk, but it was getting time for me to buy a new computer. And I was looking at the new MacBooks, which look pretty fast, but they're the only implementers of trusted computing in the world who aren't members, as far as I know, who aren't members of the trusted computing group. And members of the trusted computing group actually have to tell you what they're doing with the trusted computing chip. It's part of the agreement.
This is that TPM chip that Intel...
TPM chip. And everyone assumes, and I think they're right, that all Apple is going to do with this is try to lock the OS to the hardware. But that doesn't. But if you don't know what they've done with it, then you don't know what a bad guy might potentially do with it.
This is interesting. I didn't know. They are going to implement TPM, but they are not members of the group.
And they're not members of the group, and they haven't told anyone what they've done
with it. So there's no oversight at all.
Yeah, and there's no disclosure. And I just feel like, you know, that's a, there's, you know, the old, like, if there's a gun on the mantelpiece in Act 1, it's going to go off by Act 3. I think once you start designing computers so that they take orders from people other than their owners, you know, there's a gun on the mantle that's just waiting to take off.
That's,
I mean, you know, people talk about, oh, we'll make the computer more secure, we'll enhance your privacy, and then they design it in such a way so that a remote party can control it even against your wishes. That's crazy.
So there is TPM on your Lenovo, but of course Ubuntu doesn't pay attention to it.
Not in drivers. So
right.
I could have bought a new MacBook and paid the $1,000 Steve Jobs tax and installed Ubuntu on it. And I'm going to do that with my old. I've got a couple of 167 G4 PowerBooks here. I buy machines in pairs because I can't really have any downtime, and I just keep them in sync.
Right.
And when one goes into the shop, I just switch to the other one. So I've got a couple of these here, and I'm going to keep one running Mac OS just for whatever it is I can't get out of it. And then the other one, I'm going to get it running Ubuntu.
You know, I find there's something interesting about this conversation. One, somehow Leo switched back to talking about the Macintosh again, but
not at all. In fact,
wait. Secondly, is the comment that Corey just made that when one's in the shop, I have never had a computer go in the shop, and you're talking a Macintosh into the shop.
You don't know Corey. I've seen his PowerBooks with they're curved like a U.
Yeah, I had a machine with an 18-degree bend in it.
you don't understand, John.
I'm a clod.
You're wearing lead gloves when you type? I mean, or is this thing just flimsy?
I am a klutz. You know, I'm not as bad. Like, Charlie Strauss is pretty hard on his hardware, the science fiction writer in Scotland. I've actually seen him take a new machine and strip all the paint off the keys that label the keys in 3 months of typing.
Wow.
But I'm still pretty hard on my machines, and I'm a big klutz, and I drop them and I carry them everywhere.
He must write really thick books.
He does, and he writes them fast, too. He once wrote a 100,000-word book in 10 days.
Pounding them.
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, 10,000 words a day for 10 days in a row, that's pretty good. That's the max you can do. I've talked to a lot of writers about their speeds and what they can do over time.
You can't think faster than that.
It's a damn good novel, too.
Is it? Yeah. Man, I can't imagine that. How many words a day do you think you do, John?
About 700.
How about you, Corey?
It depends on whether you count blogging, but on novels.
Not counting blogging. I mean,
I'm not counting blogging.
Yeah.
I just wrote a 100,000-word novel 8 weeks from the day I thought of it to the day I finished it.
Holy cow.
Yeah, well, novel writers have to crank out a lot more than essay writers, and it's a different kind of business.
It's a different kind of writing, but still, that's a lot of words.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was a death march.
So, Corey, can you do 10,000 words a day?
Yeah, there were a couple of 10,000-word days in there. It was a real death march. There were a couple of on my anniversary in Rome, I was getting up at 5 in the morning to work on this book. It took hold of me, and I just couldn't stop working on it.
Well, so. See, that's the thing. You enjoyed it. It was a death march, but you were enjoying it, right?
I don't know if I enjoyed it is the word. I couldn't stop writing it.
Ah, that's an interesting experience.
You know, I've tried to do 10,000 words. The most I've ever done was about 6. And it's like very difficult to go on beyond that. It's just hard to do. I mean, it's just like, why? But people crank out 10. And I know a lot of writers who can do 10. It's like a holy grail of high, you know, production writing.
High speed writing. Kevin, how many words a day do you write?
None. Emails.
Yeah.
I get through a couple hundred emails a day.
If you count email, that could actually add up.
Yeah, definitely.
None of that counts.
I think with blogging, I'm writing like 700,000 words a year.
Jeez.
Which is pretty wild. I mean, that's like L. Ron Hubbard great.
Is that mostly Boing Boing, or is it Crap Hound 2? Mostly Boing Boing?
Yeah.
Yeah, you can start a religion next.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not
really.
That hard.
Whoopi-tologist.
You may not get Tom Cruise, but you could have Tom Cruise's doughier younger brother.
That's right. Exactly. I'll join up.
We need a disciple to throw to the feds when they get onto us. Blame it all on him.
It's his fault.
Hey, I think the first convert would have to be Kevin Rose because he's the one with all the money.
That's right. Who's going to buy your gold Rolls Royces?
How do you feel about being chained to a volcano by a galactic tyrant named Xenu and then turned into an energy being by nuclear bombs?
I'm in.
We'll make a special place for
you.
So is it a big deal that not IBM, Lenovo is shipping? I think this is the first time anybody like Lenovo has actually shipped ThinkPads or laptops with SUSE pre-installed, right? I mean, that's unusual. Or
yeah,
is it
but
not a big deal?
It's just an option, though, right? It's not like they're pushing that on the consumer.
I don't know.
Yeah. And the people buying Lenovo are like businesses, and businesses just want Windows to integrate with their Windows networks. And anybody that really wants Suzy will just put it on whatever they own themselves.
I agree.
And I literally have installed Ubuntu while on this phone call, and I tell you, it was slicker than something through a goose.
Ubuntu's nice.
I mean, there's a huge mental leap to get over to, like, I'm going to buy a machine and I'm going to install this weird hacker OS on it that was developed by a large community and not by a company. But the actual experience of sticking a CD in the drive, turning it on, and clicking install is so easy. I mean, so easy. And everything just worked. I'm like running like nobody's business.
No driver issues with Wi-Fi or anything like that?
Nothing. Interesting. Nothing. You know, there's a company that will sell you, I forget what they're called, but they'll sell you machines with Linux installed. And I almost bought from them. They charge like an extra $800. And I spoke to a couple friends, actually, Chris DeBona, who convinced me that I didn't need to do it, that it would just be dead easy. All I need to do is basically turn it on, stick the CD in, and everything else is gravy. Probably harder when you've got a machine that you want to actually keep some other OS on.
You know, that you're running that on a Mac, right?
No, Lenovo.
Oh, the Lenovo thing. Hey, by the way, just to make so people don't think I'm just a Mac basher, but I there is one Mac story I guess we should bring up, the MacBook Explode story. I think that's priceless.
Well, it's only fair because we talked about the Dell exploding, and now it's actually an old PowerBook, not the newer ones. But there was a recall, battery recall. I sent in my PowerBook battery and got a new one. Mm. In fact, I think there's a recall now on the MacBook Pro batteries as well. These lithium-ion batteries, they can be scary. Did you see the picture with a hole burned in the aluminum?
You know, this is, I think, the manufacturers, this is what happens when we get all these machines coming in from some of the, there may be some sketchy battery makers in China. I'm convinced of it. And that's, I think we're just getting some, because it never happened before China took over manufacturing all these machines.
It's
and all
the
these
Chinese.
Batteries. It is.
They're ruining it for us.
Well, did you see the Apple Knowledge Base article about My laptop produces too much heat?
No, what did it say?
Because there's been all sorts of complaints that the MacBooks are too hot, and you know, the worries that they might explode. And Apple's got an article up on the Knowledge Base that says, my laptop's too hot, what should I do? And they basically say, the problem of having too much heat from laptops is not exclusive to Apple. We recommend you use your laptop on a desk.
It's a desktop.
And it's like, yeah, thanks for that.
Well, the scary thing about these explosions, though, is that they're happening, I mean, they're in sleep mode.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just overnight, these people are, at least this guy here, he fell asleep, and all of a sudden the apartment's filled with smoke. And
it scares me because it wasn't even plugged in, as I remember. So, I mean, there's no predicting it. I mean, I'm hesitant now to leave laptops lying around in my office or at home. I put them all out in the front step if anybody wants to come by and pick them up. I have stone front steps. The United States has ratified the cybercrime treaty. It's actually, Corey, we should get you to comment on it because it's a European thing. It's the international treaty seeking to address internet crimes by harmonizing national laws. Originally a convention signed by 38 European nations. Now the U.S. is a signatory, as well as Canada, Japan, and South Africa. Treaty approved. Actually, U.S. has been a signatory. The treaty has been ratified now by the Senate. Is it? I don't know anything about the treaty, Corey. Is it anything to be concerned about?
You know, I don't know much about it either because I've been in the middle of moving to Los Angeles, but I got an email from Danny O'Brien, who's kind of got some of my duties at EFF right now, and he was not happy about this. He's pretty worried, but I don't know much about it.
This is what they say, and when I hear this sentence, I always get scared. This treaty provides important tools in the battle against terrorism.
Yeah. In other words, they're going to put some spyware in so they can stop people from pirating songs, so the RIAA gets
it's all for the RIAA.
Come on, let's face it.
That's usually WIPO. That's not usually the thing.
This also is protecting against attacks on computer networks and the sexual exploitation of children over the internet.
Sorry, go ahead, John.
No, I'm just going to say, then you're right. It's probably not about stealing music. It's just about spying on people so they can make sure that they vote Republican when the next election comes around.
Or I think the problem that there was with
did
it
I say that? I'm sorry, I was just joking.
according to the EFF, this is a, a quote, I think. The treaty requires that the U.S. government help enforce other countries' cybercrime laws, even if the act being prosecuted is not illegal in the United States.
Oh, that's interesting.
The countries that have laws limited free speech on the internet could oblige the FBI to uncover the identities of anonymous critics.
Well, I think John was actually right. This is targeted against all of MP3. Because, of course, they get away with it because it's legal in Russian law. Now they would, if Russia becomes a signatory, they're required to enforce.
Well, if Russia became a signatory and they ratified it,
and
you could get their police to enforce it. This is actually, I think, more in the other direction. This is like...
About us.
You posted something that was critical of the Singaporean government,
right.
And that's illegal in Singapore, and they want to prosecute you in the United States for it.
Well, I'll give you a good example. There's a big brouhaha in Canada over hate sites, anti-Semitic sites, which, of course, are protected in the U.S. under free speech. And, in fact, the Simon Wiesenthal Center in Los Angeles has said it's a problem because these guys... This is kind of the opposite of what you usually hear. They just offshore into the United States where it's legal, and we can't go after them. So
yeah,
that's a good example.
But there's plenty of examples of people who've tried to pull that stunt, and if they ever try traveling, like if you go to the EU and you broke some law, you know, like the Nazi stuff that goes on, because you posted it here. There's guys have been arrested, like in the Netherlands. I mean,
we extradited
to Germany.
We arrested the British betting baron, Bet on Sports. The minute he set foot, bad travel agent, by the way. He was on his way to Costa Rica, and they booked him through Texas. Big mistake.
I wonder whose idea that was.
That is a bad travel agent. Oh, don't worry. We've got a great flight for you. You just have to stop in Dallas for a little bit, and then it's on to Costa Rica and all the fun and games.
That's an outrageous British accent.
It's terrible. I know.
I like it. I enjoyed it.
Isn't that the Australian guy who wrestled the alligators?
He was doing my Crocodile Dundee. I'm so sorry.
So, Ars
Technica said that this is the worst internet law ever.
That's what Danny called it on the EFF website.
That's right. In fact, EFF sent out that message about it.
Hey,
that's right.
Hey, I guarantee there's going to be worse. So, I mean, this is the way things are going. There's one thing that concerns me when you talk about this kind of thing. You know, in Canada, because I used to write for a number of Canadian publications, and I got to lecture about this, and I'm always worried about if I go to Canada after having called, like, somebody at Intel a monopolist, because it's against the law to call somebody a monopolist in Canada.
So they can sue you in Canada. I have to be very careful now. I spend a lot of time in Canada. I should probably study up.
As a Canadian, I should point out that it's not against the law to call someone a monopolist. It's against the law to libel someone. And so if they're not a monopolist and you call them a monopolist, then they might be able to get a judgment against you. The problem is that where you have classes of speech that are unlawful like that, isn't necessarily that you will get found guilty. It's that you might find yourself at the other end of a frivolous lawsuit,
right.
that you get litigious people who use the threat of the law. So in the U.S., where it's relatively hard to actually get a judgment against someone for libel because of the First Amendment, I mean, libel's illegal here, too, but the First Amendment can be held up as a defense against it. It's way less chilling for someone to write to you and say, you libeled me, and I'll see you in court, because you know that it's unlikely, for example, that an attorney's going to take it on a contingency basis.
Well, and we have slap laws and so forth that will protect you.
Yeah, there's some shield laws in the United States as well, but... or in Canada as well. But it's more like attorneys won't do it on a contingency basis because it's way less of a slam dunk. So you're not as likely to find someone who'll just go out and do the suing for free. So unless you piss off a really rich Yahoo, you know, they're not going to find an attorney who's going to hound you until you pay them enough money to make them go away.
I do think that the key to this and the reason the EFF calls it such a bad law is that we're required now to enforce bad net laws in the U.S. and vice versa. Who has the worst net laws, though? Is it us or some other guys?
Oh, it'd be China or another country like China. But China's got some pretty bad internet laws.
So are they a signatory?
I don't know.
I don't think they are.
No, it's mostly European countries.
Yeah.
I mean, for example, one might be, Germany, where it's completely illegal to sell or talk about anything relating to Nazis, basically. And of course, in the U.S., you could say that fairly freely. But
the Germans have prosecuted Yahoo in Germany, forcing them not to sell it.
But now they can prosecute Yahoo in America.
In the U.S. It seems contrary to the whole notion of a global internet, frankly.
Ultimately, that's, I think, the biggest problem with this, is that it encourages people to balkanize the internet even further, and for there to be a German internet and a British internet and an American internet and an American government internet and an American public school internet. an American library, federally funded library internet, and for all these internets to be different and for them not to be routable to one another. And, you know, it's part of a trend that includes things like the network neutrality fight and also fights over liabilities for ISPs, where you've got ISPs who are being encouraged to block certain ports or protocols, where, you know, we started talking about the 15th anniversary of the web. That depended on it being possible for a guy to just in his office invent a protocol and a client and a server for it and send it around to people all over the world, and for that to just work without needing permission from anyone in the middle of the network. No one had to go to a sysadmin and say, open port 80 for me, please, or a government and say, you know, the web is good and will never be used for evil, I promise, therefore you should allow us to have it.
Yeah, I agree 100%.
Oh, that's depressing us. Let's go on to another topic.
Oh, okay.
Well, there was, if you're going to get depressed a little bit more, it was the feds threatening to sue the county of Maine if it probes Verizon and the NSA.
Oh, really? The state of Maine?
Which is along the same lines, really.
RIAA in court suing LimeWire, saying they want damages of $150,000 per illegally traded file, which I think is more money than there is in the actual world.
Yeah.
I don't know if they'll get that. Maybe they'll get a small percentage.
The intention there is, I think, just to scare the hell out of anyone who ever thinks about investing in a technology that right. might upset someone's apple cart.
Now, Kazaa settled just last week or a couple of weeks ago for $115 million and seems to have gotten off the hook with a lot cheaper than that.
Well, Kazaa is over with, though. They said that they're introducing new filtering technology and they're basically going completely legit now.
That's what killed Napster, right? They couldn't do that.
Yeah.
They couldn't figure out how to do that. So that's interesting. What will happen to Kazaa if they filter out all copyright violations?
Well, just
everyone will leave.
They'll have 30,000 users that buy songs, and that'll be the end of it. It's right. just because people don't know how to install any other software. So
they can do that because they have Skype. They don't really need Kazaa anymore.
I think one of the big worries about the Kazaa settlement is that no one really knows whether or not their settlement includes indemnity for their users. So it may in fact be that while Kazaa has gotten itself off the hook, its customers are still potentially on the hook.
Do you think they turned over their logs?
Well, even if they haven't turned over their logs, you think that in a settlement like that where they're settling for all the bad deeds, you know, that they're stipulating to and settling for all the bad deeds, that they would say, and we want you to shield our customers
right.
too, you know, the people who we advise to download and use this software.
Interesting. So what do you think will happen with LimeWire? Will they settle? They don't have the deep pockets, certainly, that Kazaa has.
Yeah.
Maybe they'll just fold.
Sounds like they'll fold. How do you fight something like that?
It's fold.
Yeah.
Walk.
Walk away.
Judgment proof, it's called. Yes, please.
Did you guys see that Segway? FCC approved a Bluetooth transmitter for Segway.
Yeah, what do you think they're up to?
I don't know. People are thinking that it might have something to do with allowing Segways to communicate with each other so they can kind of travel in formation.
That's a scary thought.
I think it's so they can have them recalled. They're going to send out a big
swarm.
Signal, make them all drive back to New Hampshire, wherever they belong.
I could see swarming Segways in beautiful formations, all coordinated by Bluetooth.
Just get them
like
out of
here. Art.
What could they be? Yeah, I saw that.
Attack of the Segways.
What could they be doing? Because Bluetooth only goes 30 feet. I mean, it's not a long range.
And so does a Segway.
In between charges? All right. I thought that was interesting. No, that's okay. You don't like Segways. You don't have to like them. Kevin, when you get your $60 million, will you buy a Segway?
You know, the Segways, the problem with them, besides the price being...
they're so expensive.
Besides them being so expensive,
yeah.
I think Steve Jobs hit it right on the head. If you ever saw his kind of notes from the meeting that he had when he went to see the Segways pitch, he said, you look dorky riding around on it. You
that
know, so you're
kind of
just standing up, and it's not as cool as it... I don't know. I can't see a whole lot of people just really going
that's
out
really
and
true.
Buying these, even if they're cheap.
You see somebody on one, they're first of all, they're tall, and they're just kind of ungainly. They look like giraffes.
I that's a comment I always made too, but I'm going to defend the other side for just a quick second, where I think it actually works to be in that kind of tall, dorky look. I've noticed this in Chicago.
Nobody mugs you.
In Chicago, one of the main parks, the security all around that thing,
yeah.
There's a big kind of a grandstand kind of thing there, and all the security guys are on Segways,
yeah.
And they're kind of formidable, you know.
Yeah.
They come driving up to you and they stop right in front of you.
Helps to have a gun and a uniform.
That might help.
Makes it a little less dorky.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, that's why they use mounted cops in protests. They're very effective on a big horse.
The worst is tourists in old European cities like Florence on Segway.
Do they do that?
Look so dorky.
They have Segway tours up here in San Francisco, and they're expensive, but they're very popular. But
they're dangerous, though. Yeah. I've had a couple friends that seriously just, you know, you get on there and they give you like a 10-minute instruction
they don't give you
on
training.
How to use it,
yeah.
And then you kill yourself pretty much. Yeah. I mean,
maybe the Bluetooth will help. AOL. This is an interesting business strategy. Stop charging for broadband customers, give away 5 gigabytes of storage, and then fire 1/4 of your workforce. All in the same few days. 5,000 people will be laid off.
You know, at least they got rid of their retention department.
Did they really? After that famous call?
Consumerist had a good editorial about this. They actually did. They got rid of the whole thing. And actually, Consumerist has had some good posts this week as people who are now no longer fearful of getting fired are posting some good dish about how that department was run. Guys who used to walk in and say, you know, if you don't retain 10 people today, you're fired. Have you ever been on a bread line?
Oh, my God.
Well, you get me a picture of Spider-Man by 7 o'clock, or you're fired.
This is why they had to do this, though. I mean, they dropped 30% of their business, of their membership in the last couple of years. They want to go advertising-based, absolutely free. Will this save AOL?
AOL doesn't need saving.
I think it does. You don't think it needs saving?
You know, I remember years and years ago, remember when we both did the site, we got into a debate about AOL back then, and you were an AOL basher, and that was before the stock ran up to, you would have been a multimillionaire if you put your money in it.
I never claimed to be smart.
Historically, you have just been an AOL basher. I've noticed this. I can document it now.
What are they doing with the garden? Is the garden going away? Or is there something?
No, that's the idea. The walled garden is gone, right? They're going to
There's no more AOL software. You install this, you know, you have AOL 12.0 or whatever.
I think that's their plan. It's hard to say. I mean, they obviously will have to maintain that for their dial-up customers.
I heard that they were just going to turn it into a bunch of news stories that AOL users could vote on by AOLing them up or AOLing them down, and then they're going to hire all the best people from that Netscape page. They're going to pay them money.
Wouldn't that be fair?
That's awesome.
Kevin likes that idea. Yeah, well, there's only one idea, and everybody just keeps reusing it over and over again.
It's monetizing the strategic inflection points on the global data network, baby.
Wait a minute. Let me write that down.
I'm going to put blog that one.
That's brilliant. Brilliant.
I have a website I'd like to recommend people
check out.
What
would that be, John?
Have you seen Goggles?
No,
the Google Map flight simulator.
I did see that.
Yeah, you fly around a little biplane in New York or Tokyo or Washington, and you get to strafe the place.
I love it.
So you get to get to bomb London. So anyway, if anyone out there wants to check it out, it's isoma.net/games.
I'm starting to think the single most brilliant thing Google did is this giving out this API for the Google Maps.
Yeah, it's genius.
They've got more mileage out of that than practically anything else they've done.
Anyway, I have a link to it on the blog for anyone looking for it, and you probably will too.
Goggles.
So did you guys see WorkSafe, if we're talking about interesting links this week?
Nope, tell us about that.
WorkSafe is a proxy that... So it disguises whatever website you're looking at because it's a proxy and gets around your network's stupid firewall. And then the other thing that it does is it reformats everything. It scrapes it and reformats it so it looks like you're working on a Word file.
Brilliant!
What's the URL?
It's called, I think, worksafe.com.
Yeah, well, Workspace is not...
It's unbelievable. It's how cool it is.
Workfriendly.net.
Workfriendly.net.
We're all going
there. The toolbar is replaced, and it actually has the Word toolbar, so like the bold and the italicized. It's amazing.
Is this done through Ajax? Is that how they're doing it? Oh, look at that. Wow.
I think it's just scraping. I think they just pull the page and then rewrite it. And then the other thing that I thought was cool this week was Dan Kaminsky's network neutrality test that came out of Black Hat.
How do you do that?
Well, he's got this thing he calls TCP-based active probing for faults. Dan's got a lot of signal virtues, but coming up with catchy names for his discoveries
is not one of them. Yeah.
No, but basically, he's got a thing that he says if a lot of people ran it and pointed a lot of different hosts, we would get a pretty good picture of which ISPs were throttling which hosts.
Absolutely, yeah.
And that's great. I mean, we need that. Whether or not you think network neutrality should or shouldn't happen or regulation should or shouldn't be there, I think people do have the right to know how the Internet's performing and how their ISP performs with the Internet and whether there's any jiggery-pokery going on there. And this is a great idea. I think this is awesome.
Has he put
what's the name of it again?
Yeah, URL.
It was,
it may not have put the client up yet. I mean, it just...
On Slashdot. Or no, it was on Computer World.
They did something similar. They did something similar with testing to see if ISPs would allow address spoofing, and were collecting data. Who was it? It was NYU or somebody. We're collecting data. Mm-hmm. Cornell. I think it's a good way to do it. Have the internet test it. You get enough members, enough people out there testing. You get a very good map of what's going on the internet.
I mean, that tells you a lot of stuff. Is Will back on the line?
Yeah.
So Will, I don't know if you know about this. There's if you have a BT DSL line. There's some Chinese host that you can't reach from, or even a BT resold one. We had like a Blue Yonder one when we were living in London. There are a bunch of Chinese hosts you can't reach from the UK because Sprint is their default route, and Sprint had a fiber break in the UK like a year ago, and they haven't updated their routing tables, and no one's fixing this, right? So this doesn't just catch network neutrality problems. It catches the fact that, you know, your ISP is just like lazy and badly managed too.
We assume that it's just all there and it's all available, and it's not always obvious if it's not. I mean, how would you even discover such a thing?
You wouldn't.
Yeah.
No, you wouldn't without something like this.
Yeah.
I'd love to see it bundled into like Google Toolbar. You know, those guys are like hardcore about fighting for network neutrality.
You bet.
That'd, you know, having millions of hosts or in Alexa too. You know, that's another business whose fortunes rise and fall on this stuff.
What's the name again?
It's Dan Kaminsky's site is Doxpara, like Paradox. DocsPara.com. And then this was I put it on Boing Boing this week, but it was originally at Computer World. If you go to Computer World and you search for Kaminsky, Kaminsky, you'll turn right up.
That's great. And I hope that he releases this client to people so that
me too.
We can all use it. And I think you're right. It's a great idea. Google, let's call Chris DeBona and get him to work on that. Google should absolutely put this in the toolbar. Or Alexa or somebody.
Great idea. You know, Alexa still doesn't work with Firefox. It seems unlikely they're going to do this.
They don't quite get it. George Lucas says the Star Wars parodies can stay on YouTube.
Oh, and there's been some awesome ones this week.
Very funny ones.
Sarcastic Vader was so mind-blowingly good.
Oh, did you? The one where he's like talking to the Admiral and his cube just keeps going up and down all the time?
Opening and shutting his clamshell. It was.
I literally rolled on the floor laughing.
Yeah, but Chad Vader was great too. Chad Vader.
You know, I think he's actually got someone working for him. There's someone who works for him who actually sends us emails whenever something really good happens in the fan made media stuff.
Hoping that Boing Boing will.
Yeah, you should look at this. I think that you know. Say what you will about those first three movies, and there's a lot to say about them, but they're doing some really smart stuff with their fans. And then the other thing I'd hope to mention was this Cinema Now burned to DVD DRM.
Yeah, let's talk about that. Absolutely, because that seems people are very critical of this. Tell us a little bit about what's happening.
Well, so they've got this burn to DVD program where this is Cinema Now is a download a virtual DVD, and then you can burn it to a DVD that supposedly you can't copy, and it's using Windows DRM. And no one really knew how their DRM worked because they hadn't disclosed anything about their burn-to-DVD specification. But an engineer, a very senior optical engineer, emailed me on the condition of anonymity and gave me a pretty thorough breakdown of how this stuff worked, having seen the specification. And basically, it looks like they introduced these errors that are caused by accumulation of something called digital sum value. And that this brings the DVD right to the edge of its error correction, and that's something that apparently many PCs can't handle.
Hmm.
But the thing is that some PCs can, and a lot of players can, a lot of standalone set-top players can't, and that because these discs are right at the edge of their error correction limit, if they get even the smallest damage, you know, small scratch or dust, they stop playing altogether. And because it's so impossible to precision introduce these errors, given the wide variety of chipsets and equipment and blanks, many of the tests that he did, he tested on like five machines, and four of them didn't even produce a viable disk.
Hmm.
So it's pretty crummy. He said I'm against people being fleeced by this kind of crap. How can you sell someone content on media that is so heavily compromised, especially in a format that relies upon its error correction system to maintain playability? He's this very straight-laced engineer, and he just said, like, they've designed something that is literally defective. You know,
the funny thing about this is a throwback idea. If and Leo would remember this probably more than the other guys, which is back in the early 80s, and probably maybe it started in the late 70s, but probably at least in the early 80s, there was all these copy protection mechanisms designed to keep, you know, people from copying floppy disks. And one of them was to burn a hole in the disk, map it, see where the hole is, and then when you put the code on there, if there wasn't a big defect in this thing, then you couldn't use it. It was unbelievable.
I still think they still do that. But what is the issue? So you're making a disk that's kind of not working so well. It's so what?
Well, you paid for it, right? They sold you something that was supposed to produce a disk you could play, and it doesn't.
So you can't get a refund if it doesn't play?
Yeah, it's defective, right? You produce media. It says you make a DVD that's just like the DVD that you buy at the store.
Except it's not, of course.
Except it's not, right? Except it's way less robust. It falls apart, and most of the time you're going to waste your blank media, and this expensive blank media, it's going to fall apart. That introducing error strategy, it's funny. I think the first app that did that was the Dan Bricklin spreadsheet, the first one.
Right. You're right. VisiCalc.
VisiCalc
had a defective floppy. You're absolutely right.
And I saw a presentation by Franklin and Bricklin, that the two inventors and founders of VisiCalc, about how they couldn't get their own data off of their VisiCalc programs because they couldn't run VisiCalc in an emulator because they couldn't mount the floppy in an emulator they'd stuck this stuff on it, you know, really hoist by their own petard.
And of course, now you can download VisiCalc for its 13K and run it in an emulator, and it runs great.
While we're talking about DVDs and movies, I don't know if anybody's aware of this, but you know the archive.org operation has a lot of new feature films now that they've put on their.
How did they do that?
Well, they got a lot, but they're all public domain supposedly. But we're talking Reefer Madness and Plan 9 from Outer Space and all the Flash Gordon stuff. There's a whole bunch of stuff.
Well, I think there was a post on Boing Boing like a week ago. It was all the films that fell out of copyright, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think it's not on Boing Boing.
Some good stuff.
Until 1976, you had to register a copyright and then periodically renew a copyright, and then in the U.S. And then the U.S. ratified something called the Berne Convention, or partially ratified it, that requires that you no longer have any formalities in order to do this kind of thing. And the downside of that has been that stuff that people literally just don't care about is still in copyright, and in copyright for their life plus 70 years, and where you don't even know who those people are. Figuring out whether they've been dead for 70 years is really hard. You know, it's basically now even napkin doodles go into copyright automatically, and the copyright office doesn't know what's in copyright, doesn't know who it belongs to, doesn't know who you should contact if you want to arrange to pay for it. It's
just locked up.
Pretty crazy.
Nightmare.
I Creative Commons all my napkin doodles. I just want to make the point.
Yeah, good man.
Yeah,
good man.
Absolutely. Hey, Corey, you have a podcast. Tell us about it.
Well, it's your basic vanilla science fiction writer's podcast. I read some of my stories in bits and pieces as I go in lots of places around the world, so the audio quality isn't so great, but it's just wherever I happen to be with 20 spare minutes, I'll record a podcast and put it up. And I guess the neatest thing about it is I'll do stories in progress while I'm working on them.
I think
so
that's great.
When I'm working on short stories, I'll be reading them aloud, and it also keeps me working on them because I know that I got to have, you know, 20 minutes worth of new material in a couple of days, and so that'll keep my head down at the keyboard. And so I've read a whole bunch of stories, they've had a pretty good reaction. One of the stories I read is something called iRobot that was also published on a website called The Infinite Matrix, a science fiction magazine online called The Infinite Matrix. And it's even it's gotten a lot of critical acclaim, and now it's up for the Hugo Award. So the World
Congratulations
in a couple of weeks here in LA. And
that's exciting.
I might be a Hugo.
Wow, that would be fantastic.
I am to Hugo Fear.
And well worth it. Well deserved. That's great, Corey. That's really neat. What brings you? So you moved from Britain. Are you still involved in any way in the EFF, or just kind of unofficially? Or
I'm technically a fellow of the organization, so I'm planning on going up to the staff retreat in September, and I occasionally consult on active cases. I'm still within the non-disclosure agreement, so the attorneys can talk to me about confidential client stuff without worrying about that material getting subpoenaed. And so, and I'm obviously remain very friendly with them. They're good pals of mine, and I support what they do. And I do a fair bit of work on some of their campaigns, particularly the stuff I was directly working on, which is stuff related to digital television DRM standards and international treaties, particularly something called the Broadcasting Treaty, which has really bad implications for podcasters, depending on which version they pass. But the one the U.S. has been pushing for at the behest of Yahoo and Microsoft would basically let Yahoo or, you know, AOL provides your bandwidth. AOL would essentially have the rights to Twit. Uh-oh. Even though Twit might be licensed under a Creative Commons license, if you got it from AOL, you'd also have to go to AOL and get their permission to redistribute
really?
It.
So yeah, it would behoove us to make sure that versions are available on other from other sources at all times.
Well, yeah, it would make it really complicated, because then you'd have to prove which version you were redistributing and so on. Basically, it's a set of new rights for people who aren't creators, you know,
they're distributors.
Whose contribution to the work is really just, you know, electromagnetically modulating it. You know, these aren't the people who usually give copyright to. You know, the rhetoric anyway around copyright is it's to help creators, not to help, you know. Casters.
We have a contract with AOL that specifically says that they don't assert any right to it. Does that...
Does it say they don't assert a copyright or a broadcast
well,
right?
Well, that's good. I'll have to check the contract, I guess.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
Know, maybe you can manage that with contracts, but it's just another gotcha.
Yeah.
You know, in the already completely... overwhelming, difficult-to-follow morass that is copyright. And copyright, my friend Jamie Boyle says copyright used to be like a tank mine. Like, if you were a civilian, you just couldn't detonate it. And you know, like in 1955, if I gave you a novel and I said, go violate copyright
you
with
couldn't.
This novel, it would have been pretty much impossible. And these days, we keep devising these traps that are supposed to be for tanks.
Right.
And they catch, you know, kids. They catch yeah. kids who are, like, lip-syncing on YouTube.
Too bad. What are you doing in L.A. now?
So I got a Fulbright chair at the University of Southern California at their Public Diplomacy Center to write a book called Set Top Cop, Hollywood's Secret War on Your Living Room.
Oh, boy.
And to teach a class of the same name. So I'm going to teach a grad seminar in the first semester and an undergrad class in the second.
Fantastic.
And just sort of hang around, see what those guys are up to, do a little work with the Annenberg Communication School, too. Keep writing Boing Boing. I've got these new novels I'm working on. I'm working on these young adult novels about kids who declare war on the Department of Homeland Security, hacker kids, called Little Brother.
Oh, that's good. Start propagandizing them young, I think. We really got to work on them young.
It's knocking on your door.
It's like Encyclopedia Brown meets the Anarchist Cookbook.
I love it.
Wikipedia Brown.
Wikipedia Brown. I like it. Hey, where can people get the podcast?
crafthound.com/podcast.php, or
excellent.
Just you can get it in iTunes or all the other podcast aggregators.
Wonderful. Will Harris, it's great to have you too from bit-tech.net. You were out in the States taking meetings just a short while ago. I hope all went well.
It was excellent. I thoroughly enjoyed the trip out.
Yeah, thanks for coming out to San Francisco too. That was fun.
I hear you.
You
tipped a beaker with Prager and Rose, huh?
Yeah, we had a few beers. It was pretty cool. Can I throw one more in there quickly?
Yeah.
I thought this was just too brilliant to leave out. Norton Antivirus mistakenly advises
Vickers
yeah. in the UK to delete Visual Liturgy, which is their I don't know, sermonizing program of choice.
But it's a virus.
and they said, you know, and the quote was great from the Church of England saying that millions of churchgoers have been affected by this bug in Norton Antivirus.
So you think people actually took it seriously and deleted the software?
Yeah, absolutely. Loads of preachers went through and like deleted loads of stuff. One guy was so paranoid that he thought he'd been hacked. He canceled all his credit cards and his online banking.
Thank you, Norton.
Wow.
A classically British story. Anything with the word Vickers in it, I like. Just any excuse to say Vickers. It rhymes with knickers. That's all I can say. Kevin Rose is now worth $60 million, and yet he deigns to join us. It's fabulous. You're very kind.
Not true.
Congratulations at 3-0. I gather it's a great success.
Oh, thanks so much.
Yeah, and I have to say, if you haven't played with the Flash stuff, the Dig Spy and the stacking thing and the Swarm, I love Dig Swarm.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
With a W and a 4.
A must to play with it. It's just so fun.
Yeah, it's just we have some more Flash visualization stuff that we'll have coming out here in the near future. But yeah, this has been a lot of fun.
There's some really cool stuff. We Amber and I did an interview with a company called Etsy that sells crafts, and they have a brilliant Flash programmer who's doing amazing ways to look at, you know, the catalog And I think that there's some really some interesting UI stuff being done with Flash right now. That's very exciting. And Swarm is one of them. I love Swarm.
Yeah, without a doubt. It's one of those things where as we go forward, we really want to create tools that allow you to see where groups of users are moving and what they're swarming around and what they're into. And
interesting.
You can actually watch in real time as that shifts from story to story.
And we can adapt that and show some net neutrality data up there. Show the internet swarming.
It's going to be the NSA taking over that company before long.
Hey, maybe, you know, it's worth $200 million. Let's see. Dig.com and DigNation, of course, is still going strong.
Yes, indeed.
Yep. And I loved the anniversary episode.
Oh, that was a lot of fun. Anytime we can do those live episodes, they just get crazy. Amazing.
They love you, boy. And of course... Well, I won't go into it. Never mind. I take it back.
I'll have to. I think I know where you're going.
I know where you are. And I know
yes,
where you
I do.
Are.
That's I do.
All that matters. And I'm just I'm proud of you. I'm just proud of you, my friend.
Oh, no.
John C. Dvorak, I'm not proud of him. He's once again pandering to the lowest common denominator at his blog, dvorak.org/blog. That should drive some traffic, John.
I would hope.
The lowest common denominator.
We go for the, we do. We scrape the bottom of the barrel.
Unbelievable, the stuff. The smut, frankly.
Well, you know, we cut short a little bit of smut. You know, I should mention, since Corey's on the show, that if I got my blogging, my whole blogging thing started by doing a boing boing side blog for those guys and
a guest blog.
Said, you know, this is the way to go. They have more than one person blogging, and they're writing up all kinds of weird stuff.
Boing Boing's brilliant.
Oh well, thank you.
A brilliant conception. Was it Mark that thought it up? Did you think it up too?
Mark Frommfelder and his wife and Gareth Brownwin and some of their friends published a print magazine called Boing Boing that I used to read. And then Mark started Boing Boing as a blog, I think when he was checking out Blogger for an article that he was writing. And then he invited me to guest blog to guest blog while he was on holidays. And then Shenny came on and David came on, and that's been the whole team.
That's neat. I should get Gareth back, because Gareth's a great writer. I love his stuff.
Yeah, he is awesome. Yeah. There's a big gang of people in those days who were working on Boing. Yeah. Real nice folks. It's a cool thing to be a part of.
Well, this has been our international edition. We had a Canadian, a Brit, Dvorak, and a rich guy.
What's a Dvorak?
I don't know. I said once it's...
An enigma.
Wrapped in a controversy.
Dvorak walked into a bar.
Wrapped in smut. Hey, I want to thank everybody for being here. It's really been a fun episode, and we'll see you soon. I hope all of you come back and join us. Another twit is in the can.
My friends, my twits, are you ready? Yeah, the twit army.
I don't know what the answer is. I really don't.
Microsoft poo-pooed it. They denied it, said no problem. It's going on your system. You're dead. It's a fool's paradise.
This is amazing.
In tech.